Why do we drink what we do? Why do some drinks become classics while others languish at the back of the drinks cabinet?
Is it just because we prefer those drinks, or are there underlying economic, social or technological trends that shape our choices?
And that's what we're going to explore on A Question of Drinks.
Join us as we explore the hidden side of the drinks cabinet, the decisions, reversals and underlying forces that shape the beverage market. I'm Luli Halstead.
And I'm Felicity Carter. And together we host A Question of Drinks.
Well, hello, Felicity. Now, we often start off talking about where in the world has Felicity been? And it is becoming a bit of a habit. So I would say that you're potentially being a bit of a show-off, as you've actually been on two trips since we recorded our last episode. So do enlighten us, as I'm sure none of us are jealous.
Oh, miss, I go skiing in the Alps, Luli. Okay, so these are work trips, Luli. I'm not just popping off on holidays. These are work trips.
Okay, then I believe you. So tell us where you've been and all of your very, 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 very hard work things that you've been doing whilst you're there to try and convince us.
Okay, so I do work hard. So I did two trips in quick succession to Italy. The second one, most recently, was to judge the five-star wine competition in Verona, which is always fun. So it is organised by the human whirlwind known as Stevie Kim.
Yes,
and brings together
is.
Some of the most interesting people in wine.
Okay, so what is the five stars wine competition? Is it judging Italian wines only? And I'm thinking back to the episode we did on award-winning wines, or do award-winning wines taste better, and the different wine competition rules that we were discussing. So how was the judging run?
Yes, so it's Italian wines only, and they used a sort of modified OIV system, which we talked about. So the judging was scored out of 100. But the great thing was the judges were all highly expert. So the organisers avoided what I think of as the tourist trap, which is where a lot of people are chosen just to make up the numbers or to get a nice diversity of countries involved, and they fly in because they want a free trip. So these were all very, very serious tasters, and we discussed all of the wines as we went through, and I think we did a very good job.
So, of course, Felicity, you're highly expert and you're now clearly saying you're a serious taster. So how were the wines?
I am a serious taster, really serious.
Yes.
Okay, so the great thing about Italy is it's always a joy because somebody will always hand you a wine made from a grape you've never heard of. And this time out of the nearly 200 wines I tasted, about 10% of them were made of the most obscure grapes that I've never come across in my life. So there's always great discoveries we made, but it was relentless. We did 96 wines a day.
Okay, I'm not convinced. Okay, you have to convince me that anybody can taste 96 wines and still have the same palate on wine 95 or 96 as you did on wine one. Is that possible?
It's more about, do you have your teeth at the end of be honest? That's the big question. Yes, as long as you do it over the course of an entire day. And the other thing is most of the wines are low alcohol. I think, you know, where the criticism comes is sometimes in the New World where they do 100 wines a day and they're always like 15% alcohol, and so, you know, you really do lose the ability to taste. No, I mean, they were long days, but you did them in flights of 5 and 6 and it was actually very manageable. So it's physically tough, though, tasting that many wines and trying to concentrate. I always say it's like trying to tell the difference between one Pantone colour and another. You know, you have to really concentrate.
Oh, well, one of my favourite topics is, you
yeah,
know,
that's right.
Me and my colours, yes. So what was your other trip then? Another really heavy work trip, clearly.
Oh, was it? I'll tell you what it was. My sister's always going, I wish I had your life. And I go, you know, the world looks the same from inside a conference room, let me tell you. So I went to Rome for something called the Lifestyle, Diet, Wine and Health Symposium. So this is a biannual scientific and medical conference that brings researchers together to talk about their latest findings.
Okay, so that's super interesting. And what was the biggest takeaway?
Well, mostly this year they talked about longevity research and how to become a super ager. And a super ager is somebody who doesn't become frail, can still sort of move around, but who doesn't experience cognitive decline. Because apparently once you hit 70, this cognitive decline is going to happen to most of us. And after 80,
blimey. So counting,
it's absolutely. Yeah, that's right.
Counting the years already.
That's right. There's only days away for me. So the cognitive decline, some of this is, whether you can stave it off, some people do, and that's probably genetic, but they're discovering there are more and more things you can do to protect your brain. And now most of this won't surprise you. You know, don't smoke, exercise, have good social relationships. Having a musical background is really helpful.
Okay.
But the big takeaway for me was how important it is to get as many polyphenols into your diet as you can, and just as important is to control blood glucose. So basically you have to eat as many different plants as possible. So the polyphenols are the plant compounds with anti-inflammatory effects, and they're typically what gives plants different colours. So the more colourful your plate, the better. And the other thing is to avoid any kind of sugar or junk food or cake or even patisserie chocolate to keep your blood. Yeah, I know. Bad news, isn't it? It's really bad news. We had this talk about how the Romans didn't have cakes because they didn't have sugar and honey.
That's very disappointing life, isn't it?
Yeah, that's right. And I was like, oh, really? Anyway, that's what we're talking about.
Yeah, so I try and do all of that, and I think try being the operative word. So back to the, of course, much debated question in the wine industry, which is, does that mean drinking wine is good for you then because wine has polyphenols?
Yes, of course, in moderation. But what's really important is to drink wine with food. There's been a study called PREDIMED done in Spain that says that that suggests that wine can actually unlock some of the polyphenols in other foods like olive oils. And red wine is better than white wine, which is a shame because I prefer white wine these days.
Me too.
But one researcher I had breakfast with told me he has this running experiment where he gets rats to drink wine. And he said after he changed their allowance from white wine to red wine, he, quote, couldn't kill them.
Oh, my goodness. I have so much to say there. So first of all, what are the ethics of getting rats to drink wine? I'm trying to come to, you just said that rats having a wine allowance.
Well, I have to say from an ethics committee point of view, it's probably easier to get permission to give them wine than to give them, say, cocaine. But the thing is, some of them developed an alcohol problem. That's what I took away from it. Some of them became
So that was a lovely breakfast conversation for you, right. Wine rats and wine rat allowance.
That's right. Anyway, so how are you, Lily, and what have you been up to?
Okay. Well, thank you for asking because I haven't been on lots of lovely trips like you, working very, very hard.
Break. Yeah. Let's ask you about what you've got coming up. I'm sure you've got loads of trips coming up.
Yeah, I have. Okay. Fair enough. Anyway, so apart from me working very, very, very hard, I have actually been to two great dinners at Vintners Hall here in London.
Oh, very posh. And what were they in aid of?
Okay, so one of them was the International Wine Trade Dinner that's hosted by the Worshipful Company of Vintners every 2 years.
Okay, so listeners, Lily Halstead is a very big deal in the London wine trade. So I'm trying to guess what your role there was. Was it guest of honour?
No. Well, that very generous of you, but no, not guest of honour. I was there actually because I was one of the hosts, so hosting our international wine trade guests.
Okay, well, they chose the right person. I bet you were a great host. So how did you get involved?
Well, actually, I'm a liveryman of the Vintners Company.
Oh, and
I am, yes. So I sit on the trade liaison committee that we have there. And as the name suggests, this committee is responsible for organising and hosting events at our livery hall in London. And we also fund grants for wine trade organisations and for things like educational scholarships and apprenticeships, for people working in wine.
You know, working in livery makes you sound like you're on the embroidery committee. Okay, so what is a livery company and why is there one for Vintners? And is there any sewing involved?
No sewing involved. B, the Worshipful Company of Vintners actually is one of the oldest livery companies. So it was founded, get this, 1363.
Wow.
So it makes it over 660 years old. And it was founded to represent the wine trade.
Okay, so you have to explain what a livery company is.
Okay, so a livery company is like a kind of trade association in the City of London. And historically, these companies were formed to regulate and oversee specific trades or industries. So all really about ensuring quality control, fair business practices, and really importantly, providing training for apprentices.
Which means there must be a livery company for livery makers. And do you wear livery? I'm thinking about people dressed like Harrods doorman.
No, I don't look like a Harrods doorman. So yes, you're right. The term livery refers to the distinctive clothing, so livery, worn by members, which can include robes and coats and hats and badges and things to signify your affiliation to a particular company.
Okay. So tell us, do you have Hogwarts-style robes in your cupboard? alongside your little bottle Christmas decorations?
No, I do not have robes. So those are reserved.
You're missing a trick there, Lulu.
No, well, they're reserved for the master and the wardens. So basically the four important people. But I do have a very lovely silver livery medal, and I have to wear my medal for Vintners events. But I should add in that apart from supporting the wine trade, the Vintners or all livery companies, of which obviously the Vintners is one, are really key supporters and donators to a huge cross-section of charities. So collectively across the livery companies, we donate, across all of us, over £60 million a year to a huge range of charities. So there's a really important kind of social impact that the livery companies still do.
Oh, that's interesting. Yeah. Okay, so did you sit next to anybody very important at dinner, Lulu?
I did, actually. I was really lucky. I was super lucky. So I got to sit with the wonderful, gorgeous Aurelio Montes, founder of Montes, based in Chile. Jancis Robinson was also sitting near us. And also, actually, two amazing people from the UK wine industry who own wineries, Sam Lindo and Richard Goring. So it was a lovely evening.
So now that we've done all the pleasantries and we're in a good mood, can I break the good mood by doing a rant about my pet peeve, which is what I wanted to do a podcast episode about?
Okay, so basically you're saying that today's question comes simply because it's your pet peeve.
That's right. That's right.
Okay, so I'm not sure that's in the rules for getting genuine questions. And let's not forget, Felicity, that previously you've spent a lot of time doubting my integrity on the origin of our questions. So now you're bringing your own pet peeve in. Integrity, zero. So before, just very, very quickly, before we go into your pet peeve question, I got this message from a listener last week, and he said, you and Felicity now accompany me on my walks around the Thames Valley. I've just completed episode 3 and I'm looking forward to episode 4 this Saturday on my next walk alongside the Thames. I like your blend of stories and data and I'm really enjoying it all. So thank you, listener. He went on to say, my one tip, so we have got some build feedback here. My one tip would be to add in even more characters of the drinks trade into the stories to bring to life it in an even more vivid way.
Message to receive. And actually, we should. I'll think about that for future episodes. For this episode, however, I'm going to have to pass on talking too much about characters for reasons that you will hear as we go along. What I thought was, in light of what's happening globally with trade wars, it was the right time to talk about Prosecco.
Great. And yes, because, of course, right up my street, because I'm sure, as you know, there's been a huge increase from a consumption point of view globally in Prosecco in the past decade.
That's right. And that led directly to an almighty trade war, which is why it's so relevant at the moment.
Yeah. So basically, you're saying the question for today, therefore, is why are so many people drinking Prosecco?
No, the question for today is, why are people fighting over Prosecco?
Okay, now I'm fully intrigued. But before we get into that, let's just do the 101 and make sure we define what Prosecco is.
Okay, so it's a sparkling wine made from a grape called Glera from the Veneto and Friulia Venezia Giulia regions of northern Italy. There can be up to 15% of other varieties in the mix, and it's typically produced using the Charmat method, where it does a secondary fermentation in stainless steel tanks rather than in bottles.
Yeah, so Charmat fermentation is an Italian invention, isn't it?
That's right. Yes, thank you for reminding me. It's sometimes called the Martinotti Charmat method. So Federico Martinotti was an Italian enologist who wanted a faster and cheaper way to make sparkling wine than what's called traditional method, which is the champagne technique.
Okay. So I'm going to do a high-level nationalistic interrupt here. So method traditionnel, is also what we use here in the UK. So I just want to put that out there. And also how cava is made. So not just for champagne.
Yes. And the method makes wonderful wines. Both UK sparkling and cava get a big, big recommendation from me.
Thank you.
So the traditional method is where you ferment the wine once and then you transfer it to a bottle where you add a liqueur or some sugar or whatever and get a secondary ferment going. So what Martinotti did was he found a way to do a secondary fermentation in a stainless steel tank instead of a bottle and to do this under pressure that enabled the bubbles to be preserved. This was 1895. A few years later, his method was improved upon by one Eugene Charmat, who patented the method in 1907.
Okay, so Eugene Charmat doesn't sound like he was Italian to me. I'm assuming he was French, and often, as we often discuss, all things wine history seem to lead back to France.
Well spotted. Yes, he was an agricultural engineer and enologist who worked at the university in Montpellier.
Okay, so now we've cleared up the difference from a production point of view. Am I correct that Prosecco is always made using this Charmat process, basically?
Correct, though there have been some experiments in using traditional methods.
And?
Oh, they're awful. They're terrible. Okay. Somebody once brought some experimental bottles to my office that have been aged over different years and so on, and they were just awful. Glera, at its very best, is fresh and lively, and it's just killed if you handle it too much.
Okay. So now we've cleared that up. I want to, as I always do, want to talk about consumption and who's been drinking this stuff and particularly why Prosecco has been such a phenomena. So if we go back to 10, 11 years, so back to 2014, there were 288 million bottles of Prosecco sold around the world, of which around 15% of that went to the US and over 80%, 82%. So the real majority was sold in Europe. And that's according to data from IWSR.
Now, I'm going to take a quick guess and say, I bet those numbers have increased.
Have they ever, Felicity? So in 2024, there were 684 million. Let's I'll do that again.
That's a lot.
684 million bottles of Prosecco sold. And the proportion where they went had sort of changed a little bit. So we dropped down to about 70% of that being then sold in Europe and just over 20% in the Americas. So we're seeing a sort of slight difference in that balance. But so in that 10-year time horizon, we've seen sales of Prosecco more than double globally.
Oh, my goodness. Okay, so in a way, I'm not really surprised because as well as being sort of this fresh and lively sparkling wine, it's also the basis for a lot of popular cocktails.
Yeah. So the growth of drinks like Aperol Spritz have really helped, actually, the overall growth of Prosecco. So over the past few years, you know, I'm thinking of all the places that I've travelled, clearly not as many as you,
we've discussed. Not on holiday, you also do work trips.
But just seeing how many people in how many parts of the world are actually drinking Aperol Spritz. And I actually use it as a case study when I'm working with drinks companies to develop their brand and product strategies.
Well, that's interesting. So what about it makes it so compelling as a case study?
Yeah. So I use the question, you know, would you, and I pose the question to the people I'm working with, would you drink a glass of a bittersweet liqueur containing gentian root, rhubarb and chinchoa bark at 11% ABV?
Well, my first question would be, what's chinchoa bark? But yes, no, it doesn't sound very appetizing. That's true.
No, exactly. And it's not one of your top picks. For anybody, but that's what Aperol is.
Wow.
So you can spot a glass of Aperol at 10 paces. We all can, simply just by the colour. About that distinctive brand essence that I talk about a lot. And if we contrast that to wine, we often spend a lot of time telling consumers about the detail of the taste. So in, you know, the gentian root and chinchoa bark equivalent and the vinification process. But that's not what Aperol is doing. And certainly through Aperol Spritz, it's not about the ingredients. It's about the positioning. So it's about the sharing, the mini celebrations and what it's connected to. So that's why I use that as a case study. So
interesting.
Thinking about the kind of classic recipe for Aperol Spritz. So it's the three parts Prosecco, two parts Aperol and one part soda water. But I'm not sure where that came from or who invented that. But I know my history correspondent, no doubt you know this one.
Well, I actually wrote a story about this years ago, so I had to look it up.
Every question I come up with is the answer.
No.
Actually, I wrote a story about this.
Yeah, no. Okay, so I think that was a compliment. It just tells you how long I've been around for. Okay, so basically there was a tradition from the 19th century from visitors from the Austro-Hungarian Empire would go on holiday to Italy and they would add a splash of soda to the white wines when they were on holiday. Now, you still see this done in Germany with what's called a Riesling Schorler, which is a summertime drink that's about one-third Riesling to two-thirds sparkling mineral water.
Okay, so is that still as popular as ever in Germany
yeah,
then?
Yeah, it really is. And there's even this special dimpled glass that you use to drink it. Anyway, so back to Italy. So there were these two brothers, the Barbieri brothers, who invented Aperol in 1919 and who also invented the Aperol Spritz. I'm not sure when exactly the Spritz came along, but it became a popular drink in the 1950s with tourists to Italy.
Yeah, and did they use Prosecco then as part of the mix?
No, as far as I can discover, because as you'll hear, Prosecco is actually a relatively recent drink. They used to use ordinary white wine, and the shift to Prosecco happened in the 1970s. So the huge growth in the drink, though, didn't really take off until 2003, which is when the Campari group bought Aperol, and they created the so-called 3-2-1 recipe.
The one I was referring to.
It's popular now, and they marketed the drink aggressively, so it spread to everywhere, as you were saying.
Yeah, yeah. So I should also kind of note here that dovetails in towards the trend towards moderation to a certain extent. It looks like a big glass, but actually it is lower in calorie, sugar, alcohol than some other cocktails. Mm. Okay, so talking about moderation, I have a confession to make about enjoying longer drinks with lower ABV.
Ooh, tell me all about it, Luli. I reserve the right to mock you.
Okay. Okay, I'm going to admit this. So I've recently become a fan of mixing Chardonnay with lemonade, lots of ice and lemon slices. So in fact, we did this on Saturday evening. We've been out in the vineyard. It was a really lovely day here in the UK. And it made the perfect aperitif. Now, Felicity, can you imagine how many of our lovely wine trade listeners are so seriously judging me now?
I'm not so sure about that. You know, there used to be this mocking of new consumers in Southeast Asia who'd mix Coke and red wine. And of course, until somebody pointed out, you know, what do you think sangria style drinks are? But, you know, there's a huge boom in Australia going on right now with mixing Prosecco and Limoncello, and this stuff just flies off the shelf. So you're sort of tapping into a trend with the lemonade, and I think I might actually try. You know, I think all of these things should be tried. You know, for most of history, people didn't always drink wine just by itself. They added herbs to it and honey and all sorts of things. So I think it's a great thing and I might try it. Okay, so going back to Prosecco, it seems like part of its popularity is that it can be used for cocktails. Maybe your comment will kick off a Chardonnay cocktail boom.
Maybe it will. And if my Chardonnay Luli cocktail happens, this is what it will be up against. So amongst US sparkling drinkers, about one in three have drunk an Aperol Spritz in the past 12 months. And again, that's IWSR data.
Mm. And is that the most popular sparkling wine-based cocktail in the US?
Absolutely not. No, a whopping 6 in 10 sparkling wine drinkers have enjoyed a mimosa in the past 12 months in the US. But if we compare that to the UK, we are clearly not having as much fun as our friends in America because we're not drinking as many fizzy cocktails. So the highest ranking fizz cocktail in the UK is Buck's Fizz, which is enjoyed by about 4 in 10 sparkling wine drinkers. Although we do match our US friends in the UK in terms of the number of us who are enjoying Aperol Spritz. So per the conversation we were just having earlier, with about 1 in 3 sparkling wine drinkers in the UK enjoying Aperol Spritz.
Now I have to convince, this is showing how old I am. When I was a teenager, Buck's Fizz was the name of a very popular new romantic band. And I never found out what the Buck's Fizz drink was. So you're going to have to explain it to me.
Oh, Felicity, you've just aged yourself so hugely.
I was very young. I was very, very young. I was in primary school.
Yeah, I believe you. Okay, so sparkling wine and orange juice. The band was named for the drink. Yes, you're correct. Anyway, let's move off Buck's Fizz as a band and go back to Prosecco. So apart from cocktails, we've also seen a huge rise in the sparkling wine category overall in the past 10 years. So we were just talking about that earlier. So Prosecco really caught the upswing because it's light, consistent in terms of taste, relatively inexpensive, and it appeals to a wide range of people and a broad range of palates. And most importantly, from a consumer behaviour point of view, it's just easy to remember, as basically you only have to know one thing, and that's the name Prosecco.
Yeah, so it sounds like rosé, which you're always calling the universal donor wine.
Exactly. And according to IWSR data again, Prosecco really has universal appeal. So it's enjoyed equally by both men and women. So if we take an example like the UK, that's absolutely true. And that contrasts with champagne, which actually has more male than female drinkers in most markets globally.
That really surprises me. I would have thought champagne was more female coded.
No. Well, it's partly about price, because obviously champagne having a higher price point, and typically, so I'm talking averages here, but typically women spend less per bottle on wine than men. And of course, as we said, champagne has a higher price tag.
So, okay, so explain a bit more. This is interesting.
Okay, well, when I've researched with wine drinkers, it's primarily correlated to wine confidence. So okay. Not confidence overall in life, but confidence with wine, which we can measure. So would it surprise you to know, Felicity, that men are more confident about their wine knowledge than women in most major wine consumption markets around the world? But when we measure their actual, so men's actual technical wine knowledge versus women's, actually, women have a slightly higher wine knowledge level, although their wine confidence levels are lower.
Do you know, about 15 years ago, I was in a conference and somebody actually presented research about that, and the men went, no, that's not true. And the women went, oh, I'm not sure I'm very confident about my wine knowledge. But it was interesting. But no, I believe that. Okay, so back to trends overall in sparkling wine. How does Prosecco stack up, compared to other wines in the sparkling wine category?
Yeah, again, we've got variation depending on where we are in the world. But let's just take the US, again, being the biggest market in terms of total consumption of wine. Obviously, in the US-made sparkling wine is the biggest category, not surprisingly. It's domestic, it's local, and typically comes in the lower price points. But around half of sparkling wine drinkers in the US drink Prosecco, and that compares to around a third of them that drink champagne. So again, IWSR data. But millennials are the demographic cohort who have the highest proportion or frequency of sparkling wine consumption, and they are the highest spenders on average per bottle of sparkling wine. And that's because that's related to life stage and income primarily. In the UK and US, if we look at sparkling wine drinkers there, Prosecco scores highest amongst all types of sparkling wines in terms of its perception for being suitable and perfect for a party.
All right, so let's sum up where we are so far. Prosecco is not just incredibly popular, it's also versatile. It offers bang for the buck when it comes to sparkling wine. It's very likeable across a whole range of groups, and it can be used in cocktails, so there's more chance to use it.
Correct. So unless something dramatic happens, and recent tariff announcements on the EU and US could be exactly that dramatic thing, it will probably sit in the same kind of zone as rosé, as in a safe choice that will please most people.
And it's because of all of these attributes that it caused a trade war.
Okay, so I am all ears, Felicity. There are lots of things to fight over in the world, but I wouldn't necessarily put Prosecco high on the list. Who would ever think about fighting about Prosecco? So tell me, who are the players?
Well, it's Australia versus Italy.
Okay, so as the Australian on this podcast, Felicity, am I right in thinking that you're going to take the Australian side?
Correct, I am. That's why this is my pet peeve, with all due respect to the many, many wonderful Italians out there.
Okay, so you've just been invited to Italy twice after this podcast. I'm wondering whether
you're never again. That's why I took two in quick succession.
Yeah, just get them in before you're disinvited. Okay, so I'm going to reserve judgment on whatever you say next, as we have now uncovered that you are not a disinterested party.
All right, so let me tell you the story so you can decide. It's all been written about in a wonderful academic paper from Stefan Ponti at the Copenhagen Business School in 2023. So just to set up this background, Prosecco, now please forgive my pronunciation. I always struggle with the pronunciation of this area. Prosecco traditionally comes from the Baldo, Biardene and Conigliano hills in Treviso province.
Okay, nice try at the pronunciation.
Oh, can you say it? I really struggle with that. Baldo, Biardene. Okay, yes.
You're doing well. Okay, so this is a site recognised as UNESCO World Heritage Area, by the way.
That's right. And white wine has been made there mostly for local consumption since at least the 13th century. And by the way, this was a very, very, very poor area. And this is key to the story. Mm. So the first attempts to make sparkling wine there happened in the late 19th century by Antonio Carpene. And his son finally made it happen in the early 20th century. So as far as we know, the first bottle of Prosecco, as we know it today, was produced in 1924.
Okay, so that's literally 100 years ago.
That's 100 years ago, yes.
Yeah, and then everybody got rich.
No, not for a long time. So at the time, which is really interesting, is nobody wanted low alcohol wines in general, and certainly not low alcohol sparkling wines. They didn't want low alcohol anything. So the Prosecco was sold off to wine producers, or the wine produced in that region was sold off to wine producers in other regions to be used as blending material. Now, that was sort of continued for a very long time until 1986, when there was a wine scandal in Italy that changed everything.
Yeah, and that's when the Italian producers were caught adding methanol to wine to increase the alcohol content. I was at school at the time, but I remember the reporting and people died.
Oh, no, it was hideous. So a total of 23 people died and more than 90
Goodness
ended up
me.
In hospital. It was a wow. massive international scandal. Yeah. And so for a while, Denmark even just banned Italian wine outright.
Yeah, and wine scandals, I mean, that's obviously terrible, but they often then spark the kind of beginning of change, particularly from a quality of production point of view.
Yeah, that's right. There's several examples of this, and Italy is probably a very good example. So it was a terrible shock to the Italians. So they began to invest in equipment and viticulture, and there were huge leaps in quality, particularly in the 1990s.
Yeah, and then this was the period when Italians were really kind of accelerating or re-embracing the aperitivo, so the drink before lunch or dinner, and there was a lifestyle change that kind of came around the same time.
Yeah, it's interesting. So as the quality improved, Prosecco became more and more popular, and it really took off after the turn of this century, the 21st century. But because of the way it was made, it was also affordable. And then came the big bang, the EU wine market reform.
So as always in this podcast, we end up back at politics. So what is it that caused the trade war, and why did it only affect this region as opposed to others?
No. The trade war happens because of Paris Hilton.
Oh, for goodness sake, Felicity. So I'm definitely missing a step in the story. Seriously, how is Paris Hilton connected to this story?
Okay, so let me explain. So the first Prosecco Consortium was established in 1962, the denomination of origin, right? Followed in 1966 by the establishment of the Conegliano Valdo Biadene, Conegliano Valdo Biadene white wine route, and the formal registration of the DOC, the defined geographical area, in 1969.
Yeah. Yeah, so the consortio being the group that regulates and maintains the integrity of the sort of delineated geographical areas.
That's right. And so what the European reforms did in 2008 was it gave consortio this ability to regulate the market. And so people began to think a lot about regulations and how to defend the territorial integrity. And in the Prosecco region, which was beginning to take off with this drink, they could see they were going to make money from it. The consortia realised they had a terrible problem on their hand. Mm. So the EU wine reform was all about defining and protecting geographic regions.
Okay, so I don't see the problem there.
So the EU, as you know, aggressively protects territorial integrity, right? So nobody is allowed to use the name Champagne or Rioja off their wines to piggyback off the regional identity. Mm. Nobody can claim the name Parmigiano Ham. The EU will come after you in court and it will be relentless. But the thing that the EU doesn't protect is grape names.
Okay, so again, at the risk of repeating myself, I don't see the problem.
Okay, so the problem for the Italians was that the Prosecco was named for the grape it was made from. Prosecco was a grape name, and that meant there was no way to protect Prosecco.
Okay, so now you're confusing me. So I thought Prosecco was made from Glara. Glera,
that's right.
However you want to pronounce it.
Glera. Yeah. It is now, but up until this period, it was called Prosecco. So bear with me. Okay. So just to sum up, before 2008, there was a sparkling wine made in the Conegliano, Valdo Biadene and Asolo regions of Italy. It was made using an Italian method from a grape called Prosecco, and the resulting wine was known as Prosecco.
Okay, thank you. Thank you for your very good summary.
So as the sparkling wine became more popular, the Italians realised in alarm that there was going to be nothing stopping other regions planting Prosecco and making a sparkling wine from it.
Okay. So now I see the problem. This had already happened to Italy for, if I'm thinking, for example, of Pinot Grigio. So the Italian firm Santa Margherita had huge success, still do actually, in the US market with their Pinot Grigio. So they followed the varietal labelling trend that was being used in the US that actually was not so traditional, for example, to be used in Italy.
Yeah.
And just called the wine Santa Margherita Pinot Grigio, which they still do today. But because the grape name isn't protected, they were soon faced with competition from other Pinot Grigios. And those Pinot Grigios may come from California or Hungary, and in fact, anywhere in the world.
That's right. And to be honest, it's fair enough, right? So there's many, many places in the world that plant and grow Cabernet Sauvignon, and they put Cabernet Sauvignon on the label. What they can't do is they can't call their wine Bordeaux, which is the place that Cabernet comes from.
Okay, so the Italians realise then they've got this kind of fundamental flaw in the strategy, which is that if the grape name stayed as Prosecco, they were going to soon face this competition from other places.
That's right. And there was a particular moment when they realised just how big a threat this was going to be. In 2006, a British drinks company decided to fly Paris Hilton into Veneto to market Prosecco in a can. The Italians, who by law could only sell Prosecco in a bottle, were absolutely horrified. And that's the moment they realised they're in danger.
Okay, so this is how Paris Hilton comes in. So I can see the problem, not Paris Hilton being a problem, but I can see the more generic problem. So how can changing the grape name to Galera solve that problem?
Well, that's only part of what they did. What they actually did was something much better. They took a look at the map of Italy and they discovered that there was a village called Prosecco close to Trieste.
Okay, A, that's super convenient. Who knew? And if my geography isn't defeating me, which it possibly could be, Trieste is a different region from where we're talking about in Italy. It's not the same place, Felicity.
150 kilometres or nearly 93 miles away from the Prosecco production area.
Literally like taking a map and just going, oh, look, I found somewhere.
What they did was they got some enterprising people to go through historic records, and they discovered that in the late 16th century, so many hundreds of years ago, people in this village Prosecco were growing grapes and making a wine that was called Prosecco. This comes from the Slovenian word prosek, that means deforested area.
Okay, and this wine was made from what we now call Galera.
No, it had no historic relationship to modern Prosecco whatsoever. It was a still white wine made from a blend of grapes called Vitozza, Malvasia and Tarano.
Okay, so what was the link with the wine now we call Prosecco, other than this
absolutely
random
none.
Town
there was
150
none.
Kilometres away called Prosecco?
But the Minister for Agriculture, Luca Zaia, who also happens to be a very popular politician, probably because he's very, very smart, allowed new regional boundaries to be drawn up around the village of Prosecco.
Okay, so you're losing me again. It sounds like redistricting in politics.
Exactly what it is, Lou. Exactly what it is.
So they basically redistricted, if that is a verb, in Prosecco, or in this region to have Prosecco. So what's the implication of all of this?
So by redrawing the map of production to include the village of Prosecco, they turned Prosecco into a geographic region that could be protected under EU law. And this happened in 2009.
So when did the grape Prosecco become known as Galera then?
Okay, so this is an important point in the story as well. So somebody went back to the old records and they had to search really hard, and they found the name Galera, and I think they only found one example of it, but they found it was a very old synonym for Prosecco. So they changed the official name of the grape from Prosecco to Galera. Okay, to sum this all up, Prosecco stopped being the name of a grape and it became the name of a region. So it immediately became illegal for anybody else anywhere in the world to produce a wine called Prosecco.
So there's so much going on there. So we've got our lovely wily old politicians in history can never be overstated in terms of the impact that they're having. But you mentioned a trade war, so I'm guessing someone wasn't very happy about this. Could they be Australian, by any chance?
That's right. Well, so there's a lot of Italian migrants in Australia, and there was an Italian immigrant called Otto Dal Zotto, he's still alive, who was born in Valdo Biardene, and he went to Australia in 1967. So in 1987, he started a winery in the King Valley in Victoria, which is a lovely, cool climate area. And in the 1990s, he decided to plant Prosecco, which was at the time the legal name of the grape, and it was imported into Australia as Prosecco.
Yeah, yeah. So, of course, he had the legal right to call the wine Prosecco because that was the name of the grape. So if he'd planted, I don't know, if he planted Cabernet Sauvignon, back to what we were talking about earlier, he could have just called that Cabernet Sauvignon.
So remember that he did this before Prosecco took off, you know, hugely in an international way.
So
this
it was still
part of the story as well.
Prosecco was a grape and there wasn't a region that was on a redistricted map to a random town 150 kilometres away conveniently to have the name.
And importantly, Prosecco, and this is a really important part of the story which I'll come back to, Prosecco hadn't become the international juggernaut that it became, right? So he just got it because he liked it and it reminded him of home and stuff. So he convinced other people in the King Valley, and there aren't that many of them, but they're all very high-quality producers, people like Brown Brothers and so on, to plant Prosecco, which they did, and it became hugely popular inside Australia. Mm. So they even created a Prosecco road in the region in, unfortunately, 2009, which was the year that everything was kicking off in Italy.
Okay, and the Italians then didn't like this and sued them?
No, they didn't. So what happened was in 2018, Australia and the EU began negotiations for a free trade deal, and Australia agreed to respect geographical indications on food and wine names until the Prosecco issue came up. So they had about 18 rounds of negotiation trying to solve the problem, but Australia got really good legal advice and they got a lot of, you know, records, looking back through records. And they determined that the name Prosecco had been the name of the grape for centuries and it had been widely recognised as such and they had documentation to prove it.
Okay, well, that sounds a fairly solid argument, particularly going back to and the fact that it had changed post the planting happening in Australia. So I'm assuming they won the argument.
Well, they did in Australia, but the Italians were pretty, I have to say, they were pretty harsh about it. So they accused Australia publicly of being copycats and you know, stealing intellectual property and doing all sorts of things. And so Otto Dal Zotto, who had started all this, was deeply upset by these accusations.
Yeah, I can really imagine that. So who won?
Well, they couldn't come to an agreement. So the EU did was they went to Australia's export markets like Singapore and New Zealand and they lobbied them not to accept Australian Prosecco if they wanted to do a free trade agreement with Europe.
Yeah.
So the issue became part of free trade agreements negotiated in other markets. And, of course, other markets didn't care at all about a half dozen Australian winemakers, so they agreed and Australia lost those export markets. Well, they lost it being able to sell Prosecco. They could obviously sell something.
So it kind of got caught up in broader free trade negotiations.
Yeah,
and
but
this
you can
was
see,
a, yeah.
You can see why the Italians were so worried about it because the, you know, the Santa Margherita example that you used earlier is a really great one. They could have controlled that market if they had kept their geographical name probably, but once you start varietal labellings, you know, anybody can do it.
Mm. So did they get the EU-Australia free trade agreement signed off then, you were saying?
No, they didn't. It collapsed, but for a whole range of other reasons. But anyway, the upshot is that Australia can't export the wine if it has the name Prosecco on it, but inside Australia it is still legally Prosecco.
So everything worked out for the Italians then?
Not quite.
Okay.
Remember, in order to do this, to pull this off, they had to redraw the boundaries around a village that was 150 kilometres away.
Yes.
So this expanded the Prosecco production area enormously.
So that means that basically this redistricting or reboundarying means you've got more land available so they can basically ramp up Prosecco production.
That's right. Now, the traditional area for Prosecco was on hills. Terrace slopes is where the UNESCO area. But when the Prosecco boom came, it meant that there was a vast amount of land on flats that they could begin to plant on. And so there have been major financial and environmental consequences. So the first is because there's been so much Prosecco planted, a lot of the wine is sold at rock bottom prices. Whereas if they'd constrained the supply just a little bit, it could have been sold at premium prices because it is so popular. But they've paid another price for it. A 2021 article in The Guardian detailed how the rush to plant had caused deforestation and a rising amount of pesticide use. Now, I have to emphasise that the DOCG region, which is the hilly posh part that's more traditional, came out and said it wasn't them and their wines are produced according to viticultural best practice. But in the DOC, there has clearly been a lot of environmental damage.
Yeah, so the DOCG, being the highest and most prestigious land classification bit, the hilly bit, as you were talking about, versus the DOC, which is the broader sort of flat plain, larger area bit.
Yes, and so this has actually produced a problem for the people who are on the slopes producing the posher versions. So this mass production of Prosecco has led people to come up with new quality classifications. One is called Rive or Rive to denote super premium status. And ironically, some producers are now removing the name Prosecco from their label entirely and emphasising the region instead because they want to escape the mass market perception of Prosecco.
Okay. That's really interesting. So I should read to you what wine critic Jane McCritty from The Times said just this past weekend about Prosecco. So there was this article, which is basically where they got loads of experts to list things that we as consumers absolutely should stop doing. And Jane, so they got like fashion people and sports people and health people. Anyway, Jane was asked to comment on, you know, things we absolutely shouldn't be doing in wine. So she wrote, and I quote, "Parties fueled with cheap, grubby, tank method Prosecco. Just don't. Decent champagne method Spanish Cava is the same price and your guests will wake up the next day without a Sahara dry mouth and a splitting headache."
Oh my God, that is blistering.
Yes, it is. We can rely on Jane for an opinion, which is always good. So maybe the Australians should forget about the Prosecco name after all.
Yeah, I actually think so now. I think they had a legal right to do what they did. And I think some of the accusations flung at Australia about them, you know, riding off the back of Italy were really nasty. And it wasn't just Italians saying that. I remember reading a lot of commentary in the American media from people who didn't understand the issues. And it was awful. You know, they bought and planted vines whose legal name was Prosecco, and that right shouldn't be taken away because somebody else exploits what is really an interesting legal loophole. And the Australians should not be accused of trying to exploit Italy's regional identity because they didn't. But in the end, the fight's clearly not worth it. You know, they probably should come up with something that is because this is a very cool climate region. These are very premium producers. It's a very good product. Okay, so in light of that comment from Jane McQuitty, Lily, what do you think is next for Prosecco?
Okay, so I think it's hard to predict the future entirely. So in previous episodes, we've seen how big juggernauts can crash into the wall when something changes. And the biggest threat to Prosecco is definitely the sheer volume of it. But if we think about the sparkling wine category in general, it is still growing ahead of wine and still forecast to grow and outpace wine, which, as we know, still wine is in decline globally and forecast to continue to be so. So, you know, the positives for Prosecco, it's lower alcohol, lower calorie. It has, despite what Jane says, you know, the right taste profile actually for a lot of drinkers. It's versatile. It's affordable and probably most importantly, it's easily memorable. So I think the growth in Prosecco has a combination of these push and pull factors. So by that, I mean push factors from a producer point of view. So you were talking about expanding the region geographically, the planting area in which Prosecco can be produced. So we've got push from the supply chain, from the supplier side there, and then pull from the kind of fueled by consumer demand. So we've kind of got the four P's really working.
Can you remind me what the four P's are?
Oh, yes. So 4P, sort of old school, some might say, but I'm still a super fan of it, seminal way of thinking about driving success and business strategy.
By the way,
strategy.
That's why I can't remember what they are, Lily, because I'm not old school.
Oh, okay, because you're modern. Okay, I forgot that bit, yeah. Anyway, so, well, I am old school. Anyway, so it's the 4Ps. It's about, you know, the kind of four elements we should think about that can really drive product and therefore business growth. So if we just whiz through them quickly. So P for product. So why is Prosecco successful? It's consistent. This universal style we've been talking about. Fizzy, you know, being carbonated, actually also being really important. And the product being very much perceived by consumers as being up-tempo, sharing. And we've also got the product going into popular cocktails. We've talked about like Aperol Spritz. if we take the price P, so more accessible to more people simply because the price point is lower, for example, than compared with champagne or English sparkling wine. Place, the third P, that's where it's available. So we have really broad distribution of Prosecco, both in retail and in on-premise, so restaurants and bars. And then our fourth and final P is promotion. So that basically stands for marketing, communications, advertising, PR, etc. And that's all about leading to product awareness. And as I mentioned earlier, Prosecco really benefits from consumers having to be only aware of one thing, and that's simply the name Prosecco. So that leads us all the way back to your kind of start of our story in terms of why were the Italian producers so strong in wanting to defend that name and that use of the name Prosecco.
There's actually a fifth P to add to all of that, which is Pinot Noir. Now, the Italians in that region, as we know now, are nothing if not flexible. And in 2020, the authorities gave producers permission to add 10 to 15% of Pinot Noir to the wine. So as of 2021, they now produce Rosé Prosecco.
Exactly. And then that builds into the other trend we've been talking about, which is the relative proportional growth in rosé overall compared to red and white. So Felicity, that's been the great Prosecco trade war done for this episode. Yeah. Now to see what the other trade wars that are going on at the moment and how they unfold in so many categories, including us in drinks.
Yeah, in a funny way, this trade war had a happy ending for everybody. I mean, there was a bit of argy-bargy on both sides, but Prosecco flies off the shelf in Australia. The producers are doing very well. You know, the Italians have got this juggernaut. It's done brilliantly well for them. Whether the global trade war is going to end so happily, I hope so. Anyway, but at least on this side of the Atlantic, hopefully wine prices shouldn't move very much, if at all.
Yeah, so as we're signing off, Felicity, don't... You remember in our last...
Now, you're going to give me a job to do, aren't you? I know that look on your face.
Three episodes. You have been promising to have a pint of Guinness. Please tell me that you've done this.
No, I keep forgetting. They didn't have it at Italian airports. They don't have it at Italian airports, right? That's my...
I don't believe you.
I don't know. I'll write it on my hand, honestly. I'm sorry.
Oh, my goodness me. It's one thing. You had one thing.
You had one job and you didn't do it. Oh, no.
You had one job. Okay. So I'm going to give you a second piece of homework as well, which is for our next episode. I want you to go and try something that you've never tried before. I want you to try Guinness and I want you to broaden your horizons.
I have an idea, Lily, about what it is I'm going to try, but I'll report back. Okay. So I promise to do it. And until then, this has been A Question of Drinks.
You've been listening to A Question of Drinks, the podcast that explores why we drink what we do.
And we're here to answer your questions. If you want to know more about anything drinks, from the marketing history to the economic underpinnings as to why this drink is popular and not that one, send us an email.
Send any questions you'd like us to discuss, and quite frankly, the more random and niche, the better, and we'll have a go at answering them. We can be reached on aquestionofdrinks@gmail.com. That's aquestionofdrinks@gmail.com.
And we would hugely appreciate you reviewing and rating this podcast before you go. 5 stars are much appreciated.